The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. I am Max Rushton. James Richardson is still in the United States of America looking at very muscly men benching strange inanimate objects. Right, but let's go on with this one. We have to be honest, we are not going to meet the heights of last Monday, described by one person on the blog as, quote, everything that's gone wrong with English football in the last 20 years, epitomised in 47 minutes and 52 seconds of absolute bollocks. Thanks for that. Conversely, thanks to the post that said I had an easygoing charm like a small jar of jam. Very pleased to be compared to a fruit-based condiment. Right, on today's show, we will ask the following questions. Should Owen Hargreaves play for England? Should Michael Owen play for England? Also, lots of foreign football. Are Valencia and Malaga running away with La Liga? Inter sack some bloke that we've never heard of after 5 minutes. And we have a German here, so we're going to talk about the Bundesliga, if that's all right with you, Rafa.
That's okay.
Okay, good. And we will look ahead to a distinctly average-looking set of Premier League fixtures. Right, so let's get on with it. We have a panel, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Hello again. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
You're wearing some interesting jeans with many pockets.
Well, yes. Raphael drew attention to my jeans, which do have...
Could you stand up just for Sean so he could see them?
Well, Sean's seen them already because he commented on them yesterday. I've had the same jeans on for 4 days now. Anyway, yeah, my jeans, they're sort of my midlife crisis jeans. There's a lot of zips and pockets on them.
Are you in a crisis?
I'm always in a crisis. I'm like Arsenal.
Sean Ingle?
I take issue with the fact that we don't know who Gasperini is. I mean, you know, he's quite a well-known manager. I mean, he may not, you know, make it on Sky Sports. No, you don't have the Italian football.
Look, I'm open to not knowing a whole lot about Italian football. I'll rephrase it to an Italian that I never...
Must we discuss football?
Yeah, look, we're on the intro bit where we don't talk about football that I really enjoy. And Rafa, nice to see you. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Yesterday, Sean, when we were at the Showbiz Dude, described you as devilishly handsome with the perfect life.
Ah, that's very sweet.
Is that true, Sean?
I
stick by that.
Yeah, of course.
All right, let's start with part one then. Carling Cup, no massive surprises, which is a bit of a shame, but Owen Hargreaves is getting all the headlines this morning, scored a great goal, played 57 minutes, City in there went over Birmingham. Are you happy for him, Barry?
I couldn't be more pleased. I was dancing around the office last night.
Genuinely?
Delight. No, it's nice. He deserves a break after 3 years out with injury, and it's nice to see him go 57 minutes without crumpling into a heap on the ground and being stretchered off. And good luck to him.
Mancini's already tipping him to revive his England career. Is that just a manager being nice because he's done well?
I guess what would have happened was someone from the press pack last night would have said, well, if he plays like that, he could, you know, be in Fabio Capello's squad, and Mancini would have taken the line, and us as journalists think, well, that's a good, you know, a good fresh line for tomorrow morning's papers, and have gone with that. Clearly, I mean, he's played 57 minutes and not much else in the last couple of years. If he gets back to his best, which is a huge if, he's probably England's best defensive midfielder. But
Sean,
there's a long way to go before that.
You're making it sound as if journalists habitually latch on to the most banal platitude uttered by a manager, spin it way out of proportion, and then lead with a front page story on it.
I might be.
People in Germany, will they still care about Owen Hargreaves?
They do. It's still a big story. He's still sort of identified as a kind of half German player. And certainly in Bavaria and Munich, he's seen as big news. And it's interesting because Capello really does love Hargreaves as a player, and his whole plan was basing the team around him and Rooney, which of course failed in numerous ways at the World Cup. So while it might be 75% headline at this stage, I think Capello will actually think and look at this if he does continue playing.
I think at his best he's excellent, and I can't think of many English midfielders who are better than him. And yeah, English fans, a lot of English fans, the more ignorant ones, just presumed he was rubbish because they hadn't seen much of him or any of him, because he spent his formative years or most of his career in Germany. But yeah, he's quite obviously a good player. But his fitness is a worry. He's a sick note, and he can't stay fit. There are players like that. I don't know what is wrong with them, or if it's just coincidence that they keep getting repeatedly injured, but he is one of them. So you can't... Building a team around him would be very dangerous, A, because he's getting older, and B, because you can't be sure, or there's a very good chance he won't be fit to play.
Rafa?
I just think it's really interesting when the announcement was made. I think one or two people, including me, would have thought City are just doing this to wind up United in some weird way, you know, signing yet another ex-United player. But then it does seem he does seem to have made a lot of progress. When you saw, which I did, some of the fitness videos that he posted, he didn't look like someone who's going to be anywhere near a football pitch.
It was bizarre, wasn't it?
It
was completely bizarre.
It was bizarre, and also his sort of his legs looked really thin. And in all of these videos, you only see him striking a ball once, and you didn't see where that ball went. All the rest was just him being on a treadmill, which wasn't sort of the most inspiring. It wasn't kind of the Michael Owen brochure of self-promotional videos. But it's amazing. It really is amazing that he's come back this quickly and he lasted for 57 minutes.
What about Michael Owen? Because whenever he plays, he scores.
It seems like every year. I mean, this time last year, he scored two goals against Scunthorpe. And suddenly, you know, his friends in the media, and he has a lot of them because he's very eloquent and well-spoken and he's a nice guy, start banging the drum again. You know, Henry Winter the other night was saying, well, you know, if you had 10 minutes to go in a game, who do you want, Peter Crouch or Michael Owen, to come on? But the fact is, he scored 16 goals, I think, for United in 16 starts. But only six of those games have come in the Premier League over the last two and a bit seasons. A third of his goals have come in the Carling Cup. The problem is, you know, against the very best sides, and when he was playing for Newcastle, this was more evident, he hasn't quite got it. I mean, his USP was his searing pace. That's gone. And he's still a clever player, and he's still a decent player, but he's not a top level player. And against those very good sides, he gets snuffled out.
His minutes per goal ratio is better than Rooney, Hernandez and Berbatov for United, Barry.
So what? The goals he scored a hat-trick against Wolfsburg when United had already qualified for the Champions League. He scored against Leeds the other night. One was a scuff shot, one was an excellent goal, but Leeds were pathetic. We wouldn't be having a conversation about Owen playing for England if, as Sean says, it wasn't for his friends in the media trying to promote his cause. And if he's not playing in the Premier League and if scoring against Leeds is enough to get you into the England team, then, you know, several Brighton players should be in the England team because they excelled against Liverpool last night, you know. Owen seems like a really nice guy, but England weren't exactly sweeping all before them when he was in his pomp, so they're unlikely to do so now that he's obviously past his best.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not so sure. I'm beginning to kind of come round to the view that he might actually be a useful addition, because who's the
guy you bring on with 10 minutes left then?
No, I don't even look at it like that, but who is, you know, who are the fantastic centre forwards that are keeping out of that team? Are there any? You know, does he combine well with Rooney is a question, of course, but, you know, player by player, are, even with him sitting on the bench, are there many more talented English forwards?
So you're 1-0 sure. down with 10 minutes to go. Who would you bring on?
Yeah,
who'd send for?
Yeah,
Kevin Phillips.
You bring on Kevin Phillips?
Yeah.
Genuinely?
Yeah, why not?
How old is Kevin Phillips now?
Well, I'm talking about ability, not age. And Kevin Phillips, I would suspect, has probably scored more late winners or equalisers in the last two seasons than Michael Owen has. But I would have to go and check. And I could be wrong.
It's an interesting question. It's about who you would play up front for England with Rooney and what you'd play up top for England.
Well, I think Rooney will probably lead the line as things stand. But, I mean, Defoe is an obvious one to come. I think he's improved and added to his game. If you look at his sort of stats over this season compared to the last couple of seasons, he's getting involved in the play a lot more passes to teammates. And he's working very well with Adebayor. I mean, you're right, though. There isn't a huge number of great strikers, but I still think there's a few better than Owen.
Owen seems also to be more interested in horse racing these days than football. He's got a thriving stud industry up near Chester somewhere. He's got a couple of good horses that won big races. And to be honest, he seems to have more than one eye on that as his future career rather than playing for England, say.
I mean, it's interesting we talk about, you know, who plays up front with Rooney, and Andy Carroll has been in England squad, and then Fabio has said things about what he should be doing off the pitch, and it looks like Andy Carroll's falling down the pecking order a bit at Liverpool.
Absolutely.
We've had tweets saying, you know, is Carroll destined, this is from Adam Green, says, is Carroll destined to be Liverpool's Berbatov? He doesn't seem to fit into the team, not even in plan B.
to be honest, he never was, to my mind, a £35 million striker. He had, you know, he had all right, you know, season when Newcastle went up. He had a very good first half of the season. There's clearly a lot of raw ability. But I think when he moved to Liverpool, he was the eighth most expensive player in history. And, I mean, that was too much. Even someone potential and young, we knew about his drinking problems. We knew about his lifestyle.
Hold on a second now. Well, I'm just getting tired of reading about all these people criticising Andy Carroll's drinking habits. I've never seen Andy Carroll drink. I have no idea how much he drinks. I'm pretty sure most of the people who are criticising him have no idea how much he drinks. So,
but the key is on the pitch.
Yeah, but hold on a minute. I mean, England's national manager says it's a problem. So it surely is a problem.
The England's national manager didn't say it is a problem. He said Andy Carroll needs to drink less than the other players.
Yeah.
And that was twisted into Andy Carroll needs to drink less, which means something completely different.
That's not now, twisted.
Pardon?
That's not twisted.
Then why is Fabio
happy?
Yes,
it is.
No, it's not.
The quote was quite deliberately abbreviated to make it sound like Carroll is a raving dipsomaniac.
No, I think Capello was being diplomatic right at the end of the sentence and slipped in the players to not make him look like a complete alcoholic. That's what happened.
Are you suggesting Fabio Capello is now hanging out in bars in Liverpool, keeping an eye on Andy Carroll's
drinking? I'm suggesting that if he is going on the record about this problem, and it is a problem, because you wouldn't say anything like that about one of your players if you didn't perceive it as a serious issue, it obviously must be a serious issue, because there's nothing in it for him to mention it otherwise. He obviously feels that whatever he said to him privately or other people have said hasn't helped, so going public was the next step, which shows you the gravity of the situation.
Maybe.
Also, in Liverpool's win, Jamie Carragher was at fault for the penalty. We were talking on Monday about Frank Lampard and being taken off and whether, you know, his time has come playing for Chelsea. Is the same true for Jamie Carragher at Liverpool?
I thought Jamie Carragher played very well against Brighton. He gave away a penalty, but that wasn't really his fault because Jay Spearing trod on the ball while trying to tackle or clear it and left Carragher and fell over and therefore left Carragher very exposed. And yeah, he should know by now not to lunge in and give away a penalty like that. But apart from that error, and it wasn't a huge error, I thought he had a great game against Brighton and was one of Liverpool's better players. So I was surprised this morning to read all these sort of poor reviews of his performance.
Are people just trying to write something today because there's not a massive amount of exciting football news? What's saying, Barry?
Possibly. I mean,
Kenny
Dalglish was quite chippy yesterday when he was immediately interviewed after the game by your colleague Andy Burton. Mm-hmm. I know Andy and other Sky touchline reporters aren't renowned for the cerebral line of post-match questioning they peddle. But he sort of said to Dalglish, you know, he invited Dalglish to credit Brighton with a very good performance, and Dalglish got very ratty with him and said, no, let's talk about Liverpool. Why do you want to talk about Brighton? And to be honest, I didn't think Liverpool's performance was all that last night. Brighton were very poor in the first half because they were clearly overawed, and I found that interesting, actually, because in the run-up to the game, a couple of their younger players were talking about, you know, they wanted to get Steven Gerrard's shirt, which really annoys me when I hear players talking like that. You know, it's you're already sort of going, oh, I'm in awe of Steven Gerrard, I'm in awe of these players. There's only, I don't know, 12 places between Liverpool and Brighton, so the equivalent would be maybe Arsenal players talking about getting a Chelsea player's shirt when they meet in the league. But
just trying to get some criticism on the blog with that comment.
But Gus Poyet obviously had a word with them at half-time, and Brighton were vastly superior in the second half.
Anything else excite anyone in the Carling Cup this week?
I was astonished by how bad Leeds were against Man United in what's supposed to be a very bitter rivalry. And the fans, or certain numbers of the fans, obviously disgraced themselves again with the juvenile chanting about Munich and Istanbul. And there's no place for that in the game, really. In a way, sometimes I think we should applaud these people for having evolved to the stage where they are actually able to enunciate English words the rest of us can understand, but, you know, they're just morons. And then the next day on the fan forums and whatnot, it got even worse because they were bickering over who started it or whose offensive chants were the most offensive. And, you know, Morons.
Would you like to know where you can see the draw for the next round of the Carling Cup?
Is it by any chance on Sky Sports Gillette Soccer Saturday?
It is on Sky Sports News HD.
Right.
Saturday from midday. Jeff Stelling, the best football-based show on a Saturday on Sky.
I think there should be a new rule for the sort of slightly bigger teams that they have to play everyone out of position all the time. That Berbatov, a centre-back.
That was great, wasn't it?
JT is a centre-forward. I think that would sort of mix it up a little bit, make it more interesting.
Ways of making the Carling Cup more exciting. Okay. We'll make it happen. That is part one. In part two, we will go to Italy, Spain, Germany, and I fully imagine Barry will bring up something about my personal life. We'll have to wait and see. Right, welcome to part two. It is a European section this week. In a bit, we'll talk to Sid in Spain and we'll talk about Germany, but let's talk Italy first. Let's say hello to Paolo Bandini. Hello, Paolo.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. Right, Inter sacked Giampiero Gasperini after just five games, the first manager in their history to never win a game. Were you surprised?
No, not really, which is a slightly depressing state of affairs to be in, really. But it's sort of been coming, and it's almost been coming since the very day they appointed him, because immediately when they hired Gasperini, there were lots of people who were very dubious of it as an appointment. The names that had come before, the names they'd been talking about, had been people like Fabio Capello and Andrea Villas-Boas, but all these people turned them down. So they wound up with Gasperini, who's a manager who had taken Genoa to fifth a couple of years previously, but had since been sacked by Genoa and was not, you know, not exactly at the peak of his fame, I guess. So it was an appointment that wasn't necessarily highly thought of in that sense. And then people were also very critical of the fact they chose a manager who liked to play a three-man defence and saying that this wouldn't work at Inter. So he sort of had, you know, all the critics stacked up against him from the start. And since then, it's been a sort of sliding scale of everything that has gone wrong. It's just been more and more sort of heaped upon him and blame coming his way. And to be fair, he has done a pretty bad job. He's been constantly changing his formation and really doesn't seem to have got a handle on things. But actually, in a greater sense, it's really much more a problem of the whole club than it is just him.
Even still, five games, it's just not fair, is it? I mean, no team's going to be successful if it only gives managers that amount of time.
I mean, of course, five games is a ridiculous amount of time to judge anyone on, but at the same time, I think it was more sort of the nature of how he was handling himself in those five games. It was the going from showing up and saying, right, I've got this great 3-4-3 that's going to work, to changing that after week one, to, you know, then playing Trabzonspor and suddenly going to a four-man defence because the owner had been complaining about it, then coming out and changing it again the next game. We sort of had, you know, there's been, you know, more than one formation per game every game, and it's, you know, the players don't seem to know who they're talking to and where they're supposed to be. So it's just it's really been such bad performances that you can almost understand it, even if really you're right, five games is a bit ludicrous.
Claudio Ranieri's come in. He's a safe pair. It always seems like a lovely bloke, Claudio Ranieri. He hasn't won a whole lot.
You know, I really object to this, some of the treatment Ranieri gets, because he hasn't won a whole lot. But look at the jobs he's sort of taken on lately, where he's been accused of not winning a lot. Well, he took over Roma, who were bottom of the table with no points when he took over, and he took them, despite having a markedly inferior team to Inter that year, all the way to within a game of winning the title, and then in the end, you know, finishing 2 points behind Mourinho's Inter. You know, having picked up more points than Mourinho did in that period, in fact. So there's that, and then at Juventus, he finished third two seasons. Well, he was on course to finish third the second season. He'd finished third the first season. It was two games from the end of the season and third the second season. Got sacked. The next season, they finished seventh. So was it that he didn't win things, or was it that perhaps he was overachieving to some great extent already, and he just didn't get recognised for that sense until afterwards? But, you know, he's become sort of this Jim will fix it type character in Serie A. He's the one who people call in and just does a job for one or two seasons and gets you where you need to be. He did the same thing at Parma beforehand when he came in. They were deep in the relegation zone and got them up to 12th. So Inter will be delighted if he can just get them into the Champions League places again next season, I think. And, you know, he's more than good enough to do that.
I can't be the only one now who has this image of Ranieri sitting in a big armchair in a gold lamé tracksuit with lots of jewellery on, going, now then, now then.
I bumped into Jimmy Savile once.
Of course you did.
Of course, on Marylebone High Street, and he invited me into his van in Regent's Park. I turned it down.
How old are you? Were you at the
time? I'm 32. Well, at the time, I was 28. What are you suggesting? He didn't offer me any sweets.
Well, Claudio Ranieri, funnily enough, once bought James Richardson a very expensive bag of biscuits.
Is that right?
And there's no suggestion that there was anything untoward going on there either.
No grooming in either case. Sean, you sort of shook, when I said Ranieri seemed like a nice chap, you shook your head.
I think that, I mean, he has this popular image as being, you know, the Tinker Man, a quite cuddly character, but certainly at Chelsea, and it wasn't always perceived like that. There was a little bit of an edge there, I think, on occasion.
Paolo, do you know more than us? Is he a nice guy?
Well, I think he's nicer than some. I think he's capable of being quite sharp when he needs to be. And you know, it's some of his exchanges with Mourinho, which is of course the other great side story to this, is that he had a horrendous relationship with Mourinho when they were both in Italy together. More, in my opinion, on Mourinho's side than the other way around. You had Mourinho saying, look, he's 70 years old when he's never won anything. And, of course, you know, Ranieri's only
59,
about to turn 50, you know, 60 this year, I think. So you had a lot of sort of venom while they were both there together. And now he's going to be in charge of the team whose fans are all still somewhat nostalgic and misty-eyed for Mourinho.
Paolo, I must say I'm a bit surprised about your optimism. I mean, it's only two places guaranteed, and the third one in the qualifiers next year. Don't you think that this year there is actually a real problem for the two Milanese sides, that there are teams that seem to be challenging them? Juventus looks very, very strong. Isn't it now really a serious danger that Inter might not make it?
There is a serious danger, and it's a legitimate it's a legitimate issue that you've got these four teams that, in a greater sense, all consider themselves to be Champions League sides in the two Milan teams and Roma and Juventus. And then, of course, now you've got Napoli as well, who are playing, the one team that's actually playing like a Champions League side, although admittedly not last night. It is an issue, and it is an issue that they're all up against, because Milan have only taken 2 points from their first three games as well. But I do think that there's perhaps a degree to which you still look at that Inter squad and say, well, okay, there's some old players in there and there are some people who aren't playing at the levels they were a few years ago, but really, if you go down that squad player for player, they should be in the top three, and I do think that Ranieri is a good enough manager to get them there.
Sean?
And slightly ironic that Gasperini's former club, Genoa, are top of Serie A at the moment.
Indeed, yeah, the club, his last club are there, having won 3-0 last night, actually playing very well at the moment, and Rodrigo Palacio, he of the worst haircut in football, but also one of the more underrated, in my opinion, players in Serie A, getting a couple last night.
Shout for the worst haircut in football. Someone tweeted saying, is it Jovino in the Premier League?
Well, Palacio, he's sort of got this, you know, it's short all over, and then he's got this little rat tail that sticks out of the middle of it that isn't sort of a proper ponytail, but just hangs there, and I don't know, it's a very odd look.
Well, thanks for that hair advice, Paolo, and bringing up Jimmy Savile in the pod, which I'm very pleased about. We'll speak to you soon, or James will speak to you soon, and we'll be much more learned about it. Paolo, thanks very much, mate.
Cheers, guys.
Right, let's talk Germany. Rafa, breaking news. Ralf Rangnick has just resigned from Schalke, citing burnout.
Yeah, it was a complete bombshell this morning. There was a press conference. Nobody had any idea what was going on. And Rangnick said that he thought about this very carefully for a long time, and he just felt that he didn't have the energy right now to continue. And, of course, we're only six games into the season, so this must have been occupying his mind throughout the summer, I would take it. And I mean, Schalke,
they're ninth. I mean, is that a good start for them? Ninth, or just an all right start?
It was a decent start. They had some issues. They had some issues with Raul and Rangnick. You know, they're coming off a very difficult season last year. Magath had brought a lot of players that were clearly surplus to acquirement. There was a lot of changes. Rangnick has also very fixed views about how he wants teams to play, what kind of players he wants for that system, and half of those that Magath bought weren't suitable for Rangnick's style of play. So there was a lot of moving out dead wood and this kind of thing. And they've had a decent start. They got through to the group stage after a bit of a wobble against Helsinki, and they look to me as if they'll be very much in the mix for the Champions League places. But now, it is, of course, a huge upheaval, and they've yet to replace another manager. I think it's 13 in 10 years or something like that. So they really are not exactly a model of consistency. it is interesting in a sense, because this probably wouldn't have happened 2-3 years ago. I think a manager in his position would have been very reluctant to go public on this. They would have invented some other reason, want to spend more time with the family. My wife wants to live in Stuttgart again, you know, this kind of things that you sometimes hear about these situations. You don't quite understand what's going on. There would have been a smokescreen, but he went public. And just last month, the second Hanover keeper also went public saying that he's suffering from some kind of depression. And of course, this is very much to do with what happened to Robert Enke last year, or in November 2009. So I think it is to be applauded in a sense. I understand.
Football fans more sort of sympathetic to that. If that sort of thing happened in England, I don't know what the reaction would be.
I think everyone would be sympathetic to it. But it shows you that the environment has changed, that players and managers feel able to come out and be honest about this, because, you know, it's easy to say, okay, he's going to be fine in the medium term, he's got enough money. But what happens 2-3 years down the line when he does want to work again? You know, one or two employers will look at him and think, you know, is this going to happen again? And the same about Marcus Miller, the goalkeeper. So I think it does take a bit of courage, but it shows you that perhaps things have improved and the environment, the atmosphere has changed for these things to happen and to be open.
We should flag up that book by Enke, which has had fantastic reviews.
What is so moving is that it's not a tearjerker. It's not romanticized. It's not the emotions are very much in the background, but the story, kind of the story, speaks for itself, and it's very moving in that way.
And just remind the people who don't remember exactly what happened. What happened?
Well, Robert Enke was the Hanover keeper, and he was sort of on the verge of establishing himself as Germany's number one. He would have had a very decent shot of being at goal in the 2010 World Cup. But just when he was about to be given an extended run in the side, he basically had a recurrence of very serious clinical depression. And the tragedy was that he'd become so good at hiding the extent of this condition that neither the people who were treating him nor his loved ones realized just how bad it was, and he deceived everyone until the end, and he killed himself.
When is the Enke book out?
It's out this week.
Out this week, and written by?
Ronnie Wrang.
Okay, who was connected to Enke, knew Enke, is that right?
Yes, they knew each other, and Enke had somehow convinced himself that Ronnie understood the true extent of his problems. Ronnie didn't. He just thought, you know, he's going through ups and downs, like most people do. And Enke had said, you know, maybe one day we'll write a book together. And his widow, Theresa, gave Ronnie access to Enke's diaries, which was so moving and harrowing that actually Ronnie left most of it out of the book.
Oh, okay. Really, really tragic story there. Moving on to talking about the Bundesliga right now. Bayern Munich doing very well, top of the league, running away with it.
Yeah, they've only conceded one goal in 10 games in all competitions, scored 26. They've now won 8 on the trot. Some people are saying the best Bayern side ever, or at least since the 70s. High praise, but perhaps they haven't really been tested quite yet. And it's quite funny because people are saying, well, when will the real opponents turn up? But then they've beaten Villarreal away, they beat Schalke very comfortably. Maybe the City game will tell us a little bit more of where to stand. Maybe even Leverkusen on Saturday, which is a big game, Bayern against Leverkusen, although Leverkusen have struggled a little bit. But, you know, they look as if you cannot see beyond them for winning the title. Already people are sort of throwing in the towel. The Schalke sporting director, Horst Held, has said maybe they should only play with 9 men to make it more interesting. So, you know, sort of people raising the white flag.
How well could they do in Europe then?
They have to get out of group stage first, and I think it's by no means a given. I mean, Napoli look very, very strong. City, I think, despite their slight wobble, will take some beating, and it's going to be, I think, a really interesting game on Tuesday night. It'll tell us a lot about where Bayern really are in an international context, because Villarreal were really, really woeful. It was hard to kind of judge Bayern's quality, because Villarreal was just so shockingly bad. But it's very interesting because nobody expected them to be quite in that form, because Arjen Robben hasn't played yet. So, you know, if he does come back, and there's a chance that he might come back for Tuesday's game, they look on paper much better still. So it's very interesting.
There we are. Right, so that was Germany. Let's talk to Sid, who's in Spain. Sid, are you there?
Hello.
You well?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, how are you?
Very good, thanks. So Barca and Real failed to win on the same match day for the first time in donkey's years, I presume.
They've made a very different impacts, though, the two results. Rapids was a really desperately bad 0-0 draw in Santander against Racing, which means they've dropped five of the last 6 points because, of course, they were beaten in the previous game. Whereas Barcelona's was a really, really good game and away at the kind of stadium where you sort of expect to suffer a little bit, 2-2 at Valencia.
Producer Ben says Pep got his tactics wrong.
He got his tactics completely wrong, so much so that he had to change them back at half-time. And it wasn't just that he changed them back at half-time, it was that he was already quite late in doing it. He played this slightly strange, it was almost like a 3-3-1-3 formation, and he'd said before the game that playing only three at the back, which he'd done against Osasuna, was too risky against a team as good as Valencia. He said, in fact, look at what we did last year. Last year we played five at the back against Valencia, which was sort of true because it was three centre-backs and two wing-backs. And then last night he went absolutely bonkers, played three at the back, had Dani Alves at the very, very top of the pitch, Javier Mascherano almost as his right-back, but it was quite a narrow back three. And Valencia absolutely tore Barcelona apart down their left, Mascherano's right, scored both their goals from there and created a brilliant chance for Soldado to have just a ludicrously bad miss from there. And Valencia really, really good. But then bit by bit, Barcelona got back into the game. Cesc and Messi were fantastic again.
So do you think this is a function of their brilliance that they kind of feel that they have to do something really different now to keep themselves entertained or interested? I remember Rijkaard, after winning the European Cup, then started dabbling in the 3-4-3 formation the season after, and it all fell apart fairly quickly.
Yeah, I think the context of the 3-4-3 is what the Dream Team did, and there's always this kind of almost subconscious desire to emulate that to some extent. I think with Guardiola, I think it's more, rather than keeping themselves entertained, it's more that Guardiola feels a need, I think, to keep ahead of everybody else. He's very, very well aware of the fact that, of course, that because Guardiola's side have won everything, won two Champions League in 3 years, because they won the league three times in a row, that he's very conscious of the fact that everyone's watching them. Everyone's always looking at ways to try and break them down, looking at ways to try and stop them. And therefore, he wants his team to be a little bit more unpredictable. That's one of the reasons why the other day he was talking in glowing terms about the fact that Fabregas is anarchic. He was saying it's great to have a player like that who people don't know what he's going to do. Now, there are times when I need to fix his position a bit more, but his anarchy is really good. That's why he's fiddling around a little bit. That's one of the reasons why he wanted Alexis Sanchez as well in the summer, because he felt that he offered them something different. So I think it's a reinvention to try and make sure they don't get caught out. I also think it's worth noting that all of this comes with Gerard Piqué absent. And I think with him absent, an awful lot changes at Barcelona. I think Guardiola, to some extent, is trying to disguise that lack of a player that starts virtually every single move off.
We should talk a bit about Valencia, though, top of the league and playing well, despite having lost, obviously, so many of their best players in the last three seasons.
Yeah, they do this over and over again, Valencia. You know, Silva's gone, Villa's gone, Mata's gone. I mean, to put it into context, they had four World Cup winners. None of them are in the team anymore. None of them are at the club. They've all gone. They're servicing their debt, of course, but they've rebuilt really, really well. And it's the second year in a row now that they've done this. And to some extent, you would say they'd even done it a little bit the year before that, where they've sold off their best players, €120 million worth of players, with Albiol and Marchena thrown in with those other big three. And yet they keep on buying good players in. In particular, they've done something I think is really, really important this summer. They've bought themselves two really good centre-backs, Rami, who came in from Lille, and Victor Rifu, who, of course, was the Espanyol player, who then went off to Italy and has come back again. And they really, really look good. The other thing about Emery is he's a massive tactical anorak. And he works, I mean, you know, as I say, Guardiola, when he talks about, or doesn't talk about, but when he implies that people are desperately looking for a way to beat Barcelona, the one person who's looking for it more than anyone else is Emery, and he's really, really desperate to do. Still hasn't beaten them, but he's got closer than anyone else. And he's got closer than anyone else doing something that most teams don't dare to do, which is to push really high, put Barcelona under pressure, try and take the possession off them, and really, really go for them. And I thought what Valencia did last night was spectacularly good. They could have got caught out in the end, because Barcelona had one or two chances, and because Messi, although he didn't, you know, have a great game, he provided two assists and almost had a couple of goals himself. So yeah, what Valencia have done is brilliant. Emery is a great character, by the way. To watch him stand at his whiteboard and explain things to you is just fascinating.
Looking at Real, they've dropped 5 points in a week, which is as many as they did for the first 3 months of last season. Is it a crisis?
Well, I think sort of. Now, I'm always very reluctant to go down the crisis route because the crisis is always announced so early in Spain. It's absolutely ridiculous. A couple of bad games and everyone is jumping up and down talking about a crisis. I think the problem comes from Real Madrid, not so much in these two results in themselves, but the way in which they've happened, the kind of traps they've fallen into in terms of the mistakes they've made. And Mourinho, I think, has made two or three really big mistakes over the last week. And also because of the atmosphere it seems to be creating, bit by bit, rumours and stories are coming out of splits within the dressing room of players who are not entirely convinced by Mourinho. Mourinho's decision, I think, at the weekend to single out Sami Khedira as being responsible for the defeat in Levante was I think, very, very foolish, quite apart from being wrong. I think he was completely wrong to blame Khedira. And I think that is causing an atmosphere now which isn't great. So as I say, you know, a defeat and a draw isn't good for Real Madrid. Of course it's not. And 5 points is a significant amount of points to drop, although they're still only one behind Barcelona. But I think it's more about the environment and what's going on around it than actually what's happening on the pitch that will be worrying for Madrid fans.
And Barca this weekend have got Atletico Madrid, that's right, isn't it? Who Falcao scored another hat-trick for them.
Yeah, I love this. Falcao didn't actually score another hat-trick, but I'm not going to pick you up on getting it wrong. Falcao got it wrong. There's a brilliant bit of footage at the end of the game where Falcao went up to the referee,
a guy
called Icarralli González, and asked for the ball. And the referee looked at him and said, well, what do you want the ball for? So I got a hat-trick. The referee looked at him and said, you got two. No, I got a hat-trick. No, you got two. So which the referee shrugged and said, all right, sod it, have the ball anyway. The reason is that the first goal that Falcao scored was officially went down as an own goal. I think rightly as well. Falcao was kind of reaching to a volley and put it across the six-yard box. Someone else then put it in. I think Alberto Lora from Sporting Gijón. So it wasn't a hat-trick, but it felt like it because on top of that, Falcao hit the bar. He had a goal disallowed. He had one of the goals taken off him. It feels at the moment like this guy's absolutely unstoppable. And the head of the second goal, well, in fact, it was the first goal because the first one wasn't his. The second goal was gorgeous, weaving his way through a series of players in the corner. And the header, he went up absolutely vertically. There didn't seem to be any jump, no arms failing. He just went up in a straight line. Really powerful header. He looks brilliant at the moment.
Welcome to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. We have other European news from Barry, who's going to talk to us about Turkey.
Yeah, Fenerbahce have been punished for shenanigans at their matches. And
not Lothar Matthäus type shenanigans.
No, crowd-related right. Shenanigans. And so they were, I think, ordered to play a two-match ban behind closed doors. They were ordered to play two matches behind closed doors and went to the Turkish FA with a suggestion that rather than play behind closed doors, they would only allow women and children in. So they threw open the doors to women and children who were allowed in for free, and 41,000 turned up, and by all accounts it was a magnificent occasion.
It's sort of reverse sexism, isn't it? Suggesting that women and children can't cause any problems.
Well, as we saw during the London riots, women and children would never do anything bad.
All right, thanks for that. Turkish...
And also in Sweden...
Oh, yeah, carry on.
A lesson here for some teams whose fans are, you know, their lame protests from pubs to grounds, etc. Mm-hmm. AIK and Djurgården fans...
What's the team called again?
AIK
yeah.
And Djurgården in Stockholm,
oh, right,
it was
okay.
A derby.
Yeah.
The fans were protesting at what they see as heavy-handed sanctions from authorities who've punished them for letting off flares and causing trouble at matches. So during this game, they stood in total, 25 or 26,000 fans stood in complete silence for the first 10 minutes of the game.
Brilliant.
Just complete silence. And then when their 10-minute silence was up, they sort of ran amok. At half-time, they'd arranged to let off loads of flares. So the ref had to take the two sets of players off at the start of the second half.
Did anything happen in the first 10 minutes? I mean, was there a goal?
I don't know, but one of the AIK players, Nils Erik Johansson, said the silent protest at Stockholm Derby, won 1-0 by Djurgården, had an effect on the players. It wasn't nice, he said. We understood that the fans wanted to make a point. And they certainly did that today. It felt like the game only really got going after 10 minutes.
I've been to Cambridge games where it's been silent for 10 minutes, but...
This happened at the Schalke game where the fans were really unhappy with the players, and they resulted to not saying anything or singing or doing anything for 19 minutes and 4 seconds, 19 or 4. the year where Schalke were founded. And in the most amazing thing happened that Schalke scored almost immediately after that sort of silent boycott had finished. And it was the most incredible atmosphere because there were 60,000 fans.
There should be more silence at football matches.
That's brilliant. I mean, it would really test your mettle if your team scored during the period of silence.
It would be
it'd be lots of just fist pumping.
Yeah, jumping up and down, but with your mouth, you'd have to put some gaffer tape on your mouth, wouldn't you? Yeah. Which is not something I've done recently.
Uncle Jimmy didn't there.
Still got those soccerettes in the boot, haven't you?
Chaps, Premier League fixtures this weekend. Is there a standout fixture?
I think there are a couple. I think Stoke versus Manchester United is interesting. I mean, Stoke are fifth in the league. I'm not suggesting they could finish in the top four, but
some people are,
and you know, Spurs, Liverpool, Arsenal, to varying degrees, haven't particularly impressed so far. I think it's interesting that Stoke's record against teams that have finished in the top five in the last three seasons hasn't been good. They've only won 2 out of 15, but this season they've drawn against Chelsea, they've drawn beaten Liverpool. You know, and they have brought a lot of players in, they are making a push. So I think this game will be quite significant.
But then they did get. I mean, I think the hype about Stoke, didn't that end last week when they got absolutely spanked by Sunderland?
Arguably, you could say they were flying back from Kiev. You know, they had 48 hours to prepare. But yeah, it's a fair point. And it's also fair that United have beaten them 3 times out of 3 at the Britannia Stadium. But to me, that's the pick-out game for this weekend.
Interesting bit in The Guardian today about Stoke always being shown as sort of plucky underdogs. But actually, they've got quite a lot of money now. And they do buy a lot of players. So they should actually do as well as they're doing.
Yeah, they're bankrolled by Bet365, huge, rich gambling company, get interest-free loans from them and whatnot. I don't think they do get sort of patronised as plucky underdogs. Their fans would certainly have you believe that they're hugely criticised in the media for what are perceived as Neanderthal long ball tactics. But then every fan of every club thinks that their team is, you know, traduced by the media because we have so many agendas against Stoke, as if anyone cares how they play.
I don't disagree with anything Barry's saying, but it's worth pointing out, I think in the Opta stats for last season, Stoke had the fewest passes in the whole Premier League, which does suggest that, you know, some of those passes are longer direct.
But they
are evolving, they are changing.
I know I grew up watching Cambridge United in the 90s, so I...
John Beck?
But they've got two good wide men, they've got some good footballers in there.
I once had a trial at Cambridge United.
Did you?
And it was actually on the pitch, and I actually checked beforehand, and all the round the corner flags, they were properly... Good 3 or 4 inches of grass there to stop the ball.
Well, and sand. And also, they put up in big black and amber the word quality so that a fullback could just look up and see the word quality right in the corner and just ping it there. That's when football was good.
I don't have any particular objection to teams using long ball tactics. I mean, Sunderland, in what you could loosely describe as their pomp under Peter Reid, when they had Niall Quinn and Kevin Phillips up front, it was, you know, lump it up to Quinney, he knocked it down.
England striker Kevin Phillips.
Yeah, I'm going to get hammered for that, but I don't see any reason why Michael Owen should be in the England team ahead of him.
Anything else going on the Premier League? I mean, it's not a weekend where you look at the fixtures and get amazingly excited. I think maybe Chelsea-Swansea, Scott Sinclair going back to Stamford Bridge, and he'll score them, because Swansea are playing lovely football, and Chelsea haven't looked that convincing yet at home. Or away.
I mean, they still, you know, won their home games. It would be a huge surprise. I mean, Chelsea's record in the last, I think, 3 seasons against teams in the bottom 10 has been superb. They win these games at home, and it would be a big shock if that wasn't the case. I mean, I think Arsenal Bolton's interesting in the sense that, you know, it's Bolton in the preview podcast, I suggested that Bolton would struggle, and I couldn't see where the goals were coming from. And they promptly knocked 4 in against QPR and made me look like a real idiot. But since then, they have actually struggled. Although they had a good result against Aston Villa the other night. And I think Villa are an interesting one because Villa are undefeated, you know. But I mean, Mark Landon Racing Post pointed this out. They've only, I think, had 14 shots on goal in their 4 Premier League games. They've only had more possession than their opponents once, and that was against Blackburn. you don't, you know, Nzogbia's not playing well, Bent isn't really firing. So they're a team, they play QPR this weekend, that may not actually, they may be in a false position. They may not be actually doing as well as the league table suggests they are.
I think my pick of the weekend games is probably Man City-Everton, just because Everton are kind of Man City's bogey team. And I don't think we should let today's podcast go without mentioning the fact that Phil Neville scored a goal last night, and a very good goal.
We should also mention Newcastle, because we got a lot of criticism for not mentioning Newcastle on Monday. Not for any particular reason.
I could just read out the league table from all four divisions and then everyone would be happy.
It's always on 606, isn't it? Why do you never mention Bradford? Yeah. You go, okay. Any games you want to pick out, Rafa? No, fine. Well, let's finish with some tweets. John Walsh tweeted to find out about how the fixtures and fittings are going in my flat. And I don't want to go on about this, but interestingly, I got home the other day and my housemate Gabby had moved her bed from one side of the room to the other because she said that she'd heard that...
She was sick of you hiding underneath it late at night and then crawling out to watch her sleep.
And Jimmy Savile are all there. No, she says if your bed faces north, it's bad. Can face any other way, but if you lie head to toe facing north, it's bad.
How do you know which shui, where north is?
How do we know which way north is? Yeah. Well, I mean, you just get a compass.
Yeah.
Or just you just know, don't you?
I don't know.
It's where the sun don't shine.
Fixtures and fittings in your flat.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure we're all fascinated by. Yeah. Jimbo has an interesting neighbour, do you?
Yes.
Who is it?
Who's Jimbo's neighbour?
Steve Bruce's daughter lives downstairs.
Oh, right. Trevor Nelson lives next door.
Top DJ.
Top DJ's flat is bigger.
So is it like a big showbiz house?
No. Well, no, he's actually in the next block, the block of sort of superior flats. And Ronnie Wood's got a place over the road.
Ooh. Mm. What part of London is this in?
Old Street.
Ooh, very trendy.
It is, yeah. Your jeans would fit in.
Yeah. I'd probably have to wear a silly hat, though, would I? Pork pie hat or something.
Are we done now? Good. Thanks very much. Anything else, any other business you want to bring up, Rafa, or are you happy now?
Rafa's in one of those moods now where you can see the will to live has been sucked out of him and he's like, what am I doing here?
All right, that was Football Weekly. Thanks very much for having me. Thanks for all your company. James Richardson will be back next week to regale you with stories of muscular men. He'll see you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.